Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining us today on the Wired for Growth podcast. Today, we've got two guest speakers with us. We've got Jessica Smith, who serves as president for ClickSafe Intelligence. And we've got Elliot Yerge, who has worked at Winona IT for quite some time, also serves as a volunteer for ClickSafe Intelligence as well. Thank you guys for joining us.
Thanks for having us here.
Thank you.
Today, we're going to talk about a very different topic from the path that we've been on leadership and coaching. Today, we're going to talk about a very difficult topic of child exploitation. Whether you're following, you know, what's in the news today, or maybe you have young kids that you take care of, this is a really intense topic that's not necessarily for everybody. What we're trying to do today is provide some education and some preventative measures that we think can really impact the community positively. So if you're anybody who takes care of or oversees children, we think this would be a very informative podcast today. Well, thanks for joining us. Jessica, why don't you start us off? Just tell us a little bit about your organization and how you got started.
Absolutely. So I have been in the intelligence field for the duration of my career, and I'm not going to tell you how long that has been at this point, but I've spent a lot of time in different facets of the criminal justice industry, primarily focused on intelligence gathering and analytics, investigating various different crimes, everything like that. And I always knew that I wanted to spend some time in the world of child exploitation, prevention, response, all of that. And back in 2020, I had the opportunity to start volunteering with another nonprofit called the National Child Protection Task Force, which does a lot of law enforcement support of missing and exploited children cases. And through that, in working all of the response efforts, being kind of like boots on the ground in terms of an intel perspective and trying to help find kids who had been groomed and lured away from their homes, you see these parents and these families get completely ripped apart by child exploitation, and the parents going, I thought we were doing everything right. I thought we knew how to keep our kids safe online. You know, we did this, we did that. Where did we go wrong? And you start to get really frustrated after a while because it breaks your heart. Mm-hmm. You know, and I have two young children myself, and I just thought if these parents don't feel confident and empowered in the knowledge they have to keep their kids safe, there's got to be more out there. And so in addition to continuing to support this response effort through NCPTF, I launched ClickSafe Intelligence to be able to leverage my intelligence background and the analysis capabilities that I have and be able to take dark web predator chat conversations from the very, very horrific places of the internet where all of these individuals sit and they talk about what they do to kids, what works, what doesn't work, where they're finding them, and thought this is the perfect information to be able to funnel into preventative education that we can give to parents, guardians, kids, child safety professionals, teachers, social workers, different things like that, as well as law enforcement to help keep them abreast of what the current trends are within kind of the realm and world of child exploitation. So ClickSafe was born in the spring of 2022.
Great. That's awesome. And Elliot, I know you've worked with us for several years now, but and mostly in cybersecurity and helping mm-hmm. us keep customers safe and protected against cyber risk. But when did you get into kind of this realm and develop a passion for helping with ClickSafe Intelligence?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've had this passion for a long time, but it was something where I was trying to find the right place to kind of help out, work for, volunteer for. So I did some previous engagements throughout my college years with a company called Trace Labs, doing some of their missing persons capture the flag competitions. So this was, you know, using data that was available online to try to identify missing people. And so I also then did a event with the Anti-Human Trafficking Intelligence Initiative with their Dark Webathon, which was specifically geared towards identifying different things with child predators online and some of those things there as well. And then through my grad program at Mercer's University, I had the director of the program there actually recommend Jess is someone to reach out to when I have some questions, because I want to do a thesis on child protection and child safety, and specifically some things on the dark web as well. and reached out to say, hey, talk to Jess. She's a great resource. And ironically enough, Jess had a need for some interns the last summer of my master's program, and I applied for it. Luckily, she thought I was good enough to work with the organization. So I had the opportunity to work with Jess and do some really good research through ClickSafe Intelligence. And then after my master's program was finished, I was able to come on more of a larger role as a director of operations.
That's great. I want to start off. I think there's a lot of listeners that would maybe go into this conversation today kind of interested or intrigued or wanting to demystify some of this. They don't think it really applies to them. My personal opinion is there's a broad range of people who would really benefit from the topic we're going to talk about today, whether it's grandparents or educators. I mean, Sunday school teachers. There's just a broad range. What today's listener that would really benefit, would you agree it's almost everybody?
Yes, absolutely. This is one of those issues that truly, if you have a child in your life, regardless of what your relationship is with that child, you have the potential and the ability to be an advocate for that child, to be a sounding board for that child. One thing that I encourage for parents and for kids, especially parents, guardians, and kids, is establishing that kind of circle of safety. So if you're a child or you are a teenager, like, think about those people in your life that you trust wholeheartedly. And the reality is, for some kids, it's not their parents, mm-hmm. because parents are perpetrators of abuse in some cases, or there are just other issues within the family dynamic and structure and things like that. So to be that teacher who can establish a trusting relationship with a child and make them, you know, say to that child, if you ever have anything that you need, like, you come to me and I will help you. Same with a grandparent, an aunt, an uncle, a coach. Every kid needs someone that they trust is going to believe them if they come to them and disclose some sort of abuse, and is going to say, I've got you. Let's go fix this. Like, let's get, you know, do what we need to do to get you out of this situation, to get you the help that you need. So just because you might not be a parent or have, you know, a close niece or nephew, you absolutely have the ability to identify child exploitation and effectively respond to it. And you could end up truly saving a life. It sounds a little dramatic, but we'll get into more of that actually looks like. But it's absolutely true.
Yeah. To prove that point a little further, I think it would be really good to start off with a couple of the avenues that might be surprising for folks to hear that people are using to exploit children. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of them is popular video games. I know Elliot conducted a research paper on the popular game Roblox, where we can get into the details in that in just a minute. But hugely popular game. Seems like there's a lot of traps that are easy to fall into in that game. What are a couple other examples that might drive your point home that this is easier and it's kind of right in front of people, even though they don't necessarily see it? What are a couple other avenues?
Absolutely. So I would say about 93, and a lot of the empirical research that has been done in this arena supports this, 93% of children who are abused by people they know. So it's not a situation of a child being snatched off the street when they're walking home from school, thrown into the back of a van. Obviously, that does happen from time to time, and it's completely horrible and tragic. But it's a neighbor, it's a coach, it's a family friend. In some cases, it's a family member. And the way that exploitations and the way that sexual grooming happens is so incredibly sophisticated. It can be in as little as a few minutes. We see that with cases of financial sextortion, mm-hmm. but it can go over years. I mean, law enforcement works cases where they have been conducting sting operations where a perpetrator is trying to groom, you know, a covert account essentially, and it's been going on for 3+ years. So the level of sophistication and effort that they put into this, and it's everything from leveraging a parent as a gift-giving bridge. And of course, every child loves to receive a gift. Every parent loves to say, oh gosh, neighbor so-and-so, like, that was so thoughtful of you to give little Timmy this baseball card. Everything that's done is very, very normal and average behavior that on the surface we don't look at as nefarious. We don't see the red flags there, but it's the totality of these things happening consistently, happening over time, and happening with very, very nefarious motivations. And so those are the types of things that we need to be on the lookout for. So it is the, you know, the neighbors offering to babysit. It is the coaches after, you know, asking one of the children to stay a little bit later so you can work on some extra skills. It's on social media. The number of kids who are being groomed and manipulated over social media right now is astronomical. I mean, it's, I get at least one message a day from a kid saying, I'm being sextorted online. I don't know what to do. I need some help. So it's difficult to even kind of quantify all of the different ways that this is happening because it is happening in so many different places. I'd love to dive into the gaming a little bit more, though, because it is such an under-discussed topic currently.
I think parents would be shocked to learn that a child with an iPad playing some video games, I mean, that is a huge avenue towards some very dangerous activities. Let's talk a little bit about that. Maybe we could even use that exact example. Mm-hmm. How can something seemingly so common and innocent, how can that really fly off the rails into something, you know, hugely dangerous?
I think one of the big things is so many online games these days have chat features. And I'll be perfectly honest, that encompasses about 90% of the problem. There is still exposure to inappropriate content. There is a lot of tangential social media and messaging apps that are very integral to a lot of these games, such as Discord or Telegram conversations and things like that. It's just kind of part of the culture. But when these chat applications within the game are left unchecked, and you also have games where collaboration and interaction is not just a built-in function, but it's almost like an integral functionality of that game. So like Among Us, for example, it's collaborative. It's meant to be, you know, working together, teamwork, all of that. Once you open that up and you have this ability to connect with strangers, all bets are off at that point. And so you can take something as wonderful as Roblox, which encourages kids to code. It encourages them to learn new skills. They get to play all of these different wonderful, amazing games and have all of these different awesome experiences. But all it takes is the one wrong person to say, hey, what you doing? How old are you? And the door has been kicked open. So, and Elliot can share some examples of that specifically.
Yeah, for sure. And the one thing too with that is like the cross-platform component of these games. You know, you gave your kid an iPad, it has Roblox on it. Someone doesn't need to have an iPad to play Roblox. It can be a computer, it can be a MacBook, it can be Xbox, PlayStation, Nintendo Switch, what have you. That this person across the world, anyone out there, can potentially be talking to your child. And without those type of situations where like maybe there isn't any parental controls on the device, or you don't know how to play Roblox. You don't know what, you know, certain slang means. You don't know what, you don't even know how to use the application. But your child does. They're playing this game, oftentimes probably playing it for a while. They love, because, you know, kids love to explore, love to build, love to be creative. Especially like I know when I was younger, like using Legos and things like that, like super fun. That's the new version of that, and allowing kids to be able to use their imagination.
So we've got parents and grandparents rushing to the iPad right now to uninstall Roblox. I guess let's be really clear. We're not saying that these games are inherently bad. What we're saying is that they are often overlooked as avenues to connect people who mean kids harm directly to young kids, right? Is that the clarification?
Yes, absolutely. No platform is inherently evil in the sense of, you know, this, you know, Roblox as the example, like it's not bad. They have a lot of people in their trust and safety team that are monitoring these things, but with a knife, You can use it to butter bread. You can use it to stab someone.
Sure.
It's, you know, the use of that tool and the use of the people using that tool can change the scope of what happens or, you know, how it's being used. Oftentimes some people use it maliciously against children.
So I think of more, there's a couple of technologies or platforms that I think parents would associate as having quite a bit of danger. I know, at least in our circle, platforms like Snapchat, for example, it's become known that these can be very dangerous platforms. Roblox, I think that would be a surprise to a lot of folks. What would be another avenue that you've investigated, either one of you, that look, we really need to be cautious about, and it's overlooked?
We're probably both thinking the same thing here.
Potentially.
I love Discord. The trust and safety team at Discord is, I'll go out on a limb and say, actually one of the, probably the most hardworking in the industry. Discord is kind of one of the few organizations that was really actively investing in trust and safety, specifically exploitative content and engagement. You know, you'd think trust and safety, sometimes that can mean fraud, it can mean scams, it can mean cybersecurity, different things like that. But they specifically have an exploitative content team because they recognized, they saw what was happening on their platform, and they said, we gotta stop this. They intentionally refused to implement end-to-end encryption, which, again, all of us in this industry, like, we cannot help but applaud from a privacy perspective. Yes, we want to make sure that user privacy is prioritized and that it has cared for and it's treated with respect, but it's very difficult to investigate child exploitation cases with messaging apps and platforms that have that end-to-end encrypted encryption technology. But Discord is one of those that I think most parents just truly have never heard of. So they might not, you know, it's not that they have heard it's inherently bad. They haven't heard that it's inherently good. It's just so new that if a child goes, "Mom, I want to install Discord so I can talk to my friends," the parent's going to say, "Well, what is it?" And the kid's going to say, "It's like Facebook Messenger, so I can talk to so-and-so from school." And with a parent making that connection to Facebook Messenger, which they use, and they go, "Okay, well, you have to know the person and you have to accept the messages. Like, I think that seems safe. That seems okay." Whereas, unfortunately, there are a lot of channels and servers within Discord where some very nefarious things are happening, and Discord, try as they might, they're drinking from a massive fire hose every day. They just can't catch everything.
Yeah, I saw a recent interview. I think there was a congressional hearing where CEOs from Facebook and all the major platforms were there. Mm-hmm. And I remember the CEO of Discord was asked, "Are you prepared to enforce these new laws that we're putting into place?" And his answer was, "No, we're not prepared today." It's a huge undertaking, isn't it? And what really causes this to be such an issue? Is it just that we're always behind the curve? Is it the volume? You know, we've got millions of users. What causes child exploitation to fly under the radar on these platforms? Even Facebook, I think everybody would agree there's tons of, you know, pretty horrible content on Facebook. But what's the biggest issue here?
And this is Jessica's kind of opinion on this. I think one of the reasons that none of the CEOs during that hearing were willing to say, "Yes, we will sign, we will accept this," is because the new laws are opening up social media companies to liability. Mm. And if we're being completely honest, no for-profit entity in their right mind, when they currently have protections against liability, is going to say, "Oh yeah, take that away from us." So like, I can't blame any of them for saying no. However, that said, when we look at, like, how has it gotten this bad? I've said this in so many times in other facets and other places. You don't design things like this thinking that they're going to be exploited for nefarious purposes. And the creators of these platforms, they want to be innovative. They want to be cutting edge. They want to build something that, you know, helps kind of move the world in a new direction. But when you don't have that frame of mind, you know, there's not many of us who are willing to study and immerse ourselves in the world of child exploitation, because it's a really, really hard world and life to live.
Yeah.
So when you, it's an issue of you don't know what you don't know. And then when you're not doing it ahead of time, you are massively behind the curve. Like you said, the reality is as soon as you implement those detection systems based on language or hashtags, the predators have already started pivoting.
Sure.
Because they know that they have to stay not just one step ahead, but three steps ahead. And so they are working within these little tiny pockets and communities, be it on the dark web or in very hidden places of the clear web, to develop new vernacular, to help advertise their content, to help move their little factions around. And so it does become this just game of cat and mouse for these social media companies to try to not only catch up, but then to actually get ahead, to be able to stop it before it starts happening versus continually just playing block, 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 block.
Sure.
Yeah. Did you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, Ellie? there was some recent investigations we did on some social media platforms where, you know, some of the auto detections and the auto moderation was great. It would block hashtags, it would block, you know, accounts from being made as soon as they were made. But then you would look and dive an inch deeper. There's dozens and dozens and dozens of accounts with child sexual abuse material and other types of accounts with hundreds and hundreds of followers. And you know what? Like a lot, like as Jessica was mentioning, like it's hard. And also, like, anytime, like, if it misses the auto moderation, it goes to manual review. Mm-hmm. And then having the staff to do that. And then also, if it is confirmed, then that's a legal process. And that's a whole other can of worms that then these businesses have to mandatory report and then deal with the investigation to see if it's whether it's known, whether it's new, identification of victims and other things like that, where it's just, and you know, it's profit. Company, it's money the company has to spend on that.
Let me ask this question then. I'm not suggesting this is my personal opinion, but there's a line of thinking out there that would say, hey, a private entity like Facebook they're not responsible for protecting your kids. Do we all agree that what we're really aiming for is a shared responsibility model at the end of the day, where there's mechanisms in place, but then there is accountability on the home front as well? Is that what you're advocating for?
Absolutely. You can look at any issue across, you know, pick all of the political issues that we face on a day-to-day basis. None of them are black and white. None of them are going to be fixed by plugging one hole in the boat. It has to be something where we tackle it from all sides, and everybody has to have that same shared goal. And truly, it doesn't behoove anyone in the conversation when we say, the social media companies have to do better. This is on them. The blood is on their hands. Well, I mean, to an extent, yeah, they could do better. They could absolutely do better. Schools could incorporate more education into their curriculums. We could be educating parents more, giving them education to be able to help their kids. There's so many different ways that this cat needs to be skinned, if you will, that we cannot just place all the blame on social media companies. It absolutely is a shared responsibility here. And until everybody does start doing their part, we're going to be one step behind.
Totally makes sense. And I agree with that. Using the example of Facebook, Snapchat, Discord, we talked about Roblox or Minecraft, whatever it might be. What are a couple examples of ways in which the parents or the guardians at home can help prevent those from becoming, you know, malicious avenues?
I think we could probably tag team this one a little bit. So one of the first things that I always tell parents is no devices in bedrooms, bathrooms, or behind closed doors. The majority of self-generated child sexual abuse material, and when we say self-generated, we mean material where the child is either, you know, willingly taking a photo and sending it, or coerced, manipulated, or blackmailed into filming or taking photos of themselves and sending it. That's what we mean by self-generated, even though we understand that they have been usually manipulated into doing so. The majority of that, usually 3 out of 4 cases, happens in a family home bedroom or in a family home bathroom. Mm. A lot of times, if it's a video, parents can even be heard outside in the background of that video behind that closed door, you know, calling because it's time to go do your homework or it's time to eat dinner. So no devices in bedrooms or bathrooms, particularly no devices in bedrooms or bathrooms like overnight. Mm-hmm. And that is something that is very good to have just as a family rule. That way kids don't feel like they're being punished. It's just something that we all do as a family. And you have like your charging station. Yep. And that means you have to go get your analog alarm clock from Amazon or Walmart or what have you, then that's what you do, because it's just simply a family rule. It's something that we all do. Do you want to offer up something too?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the biggest things that I found is that fear of not knowing what your kids are doing. And it's that apprehension of like kind of learning that and like knowing that. So a lot of these tool sets like Roblox, Minecraft, any of these gaming platforms specifically, they do have safety settings. They do have safety features. Are they enabled by default? Not necessarily. Roblox specifically, when we did our study on it, they weren't. Like I made two accounts for 2 9-year-olds and I could talk to adults. And they have really good protections in place still. Like they have some chat filtering and some other areas that still like, you know, protect the child.
Sure.
But if these default settings that even prevent chatting isn't even known about by the parents, then it's never going to be turned on. And so that's where it's like learning the things your kids are doing, taking investment in them, even playing the games yourself as a parent. Like, yes, you may think it's very lame or it's like, hey, your kid's going to love you because you get to talk to them about the thing they love the most at the moment, like Roblox, Minecraft, anything out there. So it's a really good connection opportunity, but also it allows you to keep your kids safe. If you know the settings, you know how the game works, you know how the app works, or like, you know, a lot of these platforms do have some protections in place, not all of them. Mm. But some do. So like being able to just know it, not be afraid to learn it, I think is a big one.
So one of the questions that may come up is, let's say grandparents out there and they get to watch a grandchild, you know, once a week, and they want to know, okay, so, you know, do I have to learn how to use these applications? Do I need to learn how to fire up the video game? I mean, are there technologies that we can implement out maybe at the firewall level or otherwise? Are there technologies that we can leverage that will take care of an element of this for us or not so much?
There are. So there are applications like Bark out there which do some monitoring. Now, the thing with any of these types of applications is everything has to be set up and connected. Right. So if you are going to leverage Bark to help keep your child safe, you have to then link their Instagram account, their Facebook account, their Snapchat account. And I'm not sure if Bark, I'll be perfectly honest, I'm not even sure if they do gaming platforms as well. So these should be used as an additional tool, as additional resource, not the entire life preserver. The manual interaction of going in and learning the games is incredibly important, in part because, A, you need to understand the idiosyncrasies of how each application and game functions. Now, if grandma and grandpa are only watching the child once a week, maybe it is something where, you know, this primarily falls on parents, primary caregivers, and they set parameters like you can only play this for 1 hour a day. You're going to play it in the living room right next to us so that we can keep an eye on you. And so you have that level of kind of oversight in that regard. But the manual component in the learning, not just for the idiosyncratic understanding of how each platform functions, because it's all going to be differently, is they change their privacy settings very regularly. Mm. Like how many of us actually know every time Facebook implements a new privacy update? And how many of us actually go in and like scan through that ridiculous fine print? Exactly. Nobody. So the more that you are in there, the more that you are engaging with your child, the more that you are paying attention to it and doing the work yourself for your own platform your own account on that platform that you are managing, the better and more likely you are going to be to catch the things that you need to help keep your child safe. So
I think another big one too is that a lot of these platforms, like two biggest ones, like Apple ecosystem and then Xbox as well, like they have family accounts, they have screen time settings, like actually setting those like technical restrictions on these devices goes a long ways because guess what? Then the kids can't go past it. Well, if they know the passcode, then make it hard for your kid to guess. 1, 2, 3, 4 doesn't exactly cut it. But it's one of those things where, you know, these hard controls are in place where, you know, hey, I said you could play an hour on the iPad with this app, shuts down after an hour, and you don't have to wait till tomorrow when, hey, I'm back at my parents' house. Mm-hmm. And, you know, grandma and grandpa in that example, they know they're allowed to play for an hour and they can even watch over their shoulder. Mm-hmm. Things like that to kind of help mitigate some of those things. Or some of those communications. I think even Xbox can even look at some of those communications that the kids have as well. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
So we've talked about a handful of preventative measures, and there'll be resources we can throw in the description to give parents and guardians a little bit more information there. I guess one of the questions I wanted to talk about today is a question we get all the time. Hey, what age can I give my kids a device? And it feels like parents are somehow expecting these issues to be less prevalent or their kids to be less susceptible or what have you when the kid, you know, turns 12 or something magical, which is not the case and certainly not what the research suggests. How do you address the question of what age should I give my child a phone or a device?
So I'm going to give you the lawyer answer here, and that is going to be it depends. It depends on the child. It depends on the child's friends. It depends on what that child wants to do with that phone. You know, if they are like, look, I really just want to have something so that I can contact you when I'm at a friend's house if I need to get picked up. Because the reality is most people don't have landlines anymore. They just rely on cell phones, right? And so the answer is going to vary based on all of those different factors. And the one thing that I will say is you as a parent know your child better than anybody, right? You know their emotional maturity. You know how many conversations you have had about in-person safety, about online safety. And there are also smaller kind of escalations in electronic devices that you can leverage. You don't just have to go handing your 7-year-old an iPhone that has, you know, free reign access to the internet, if you will. So I strongly encourage for parents to opt for the watches, you know, like there's the Gizmo watch and there's the Sync Up Kids watch. This is a great way to make sure that they can stay in contact with you when they're at a friend's house or running around the neighborhood. Flip phones, which, you know, don't have access to the internet, those do still exist. We have to hunt for them a little bit, but that's a great way to make sure that you can contact your child. If we're truly talking about a smartphone with social media access, mm-hmm. with internet access, that I like to tell parents, try to wait until after middle school. So after kind of like that 14 age, there is something that happens within kind of that like 12 to 14 age range. And granted, we know from research that even adults, you know, individuals under the age of 25, like they're still undergoing white matter development within their brain, and they're getting all of that like rational thinking and cognitive development. And once we hit 25, it is a lot. We just make better decisions. But something about that middle school time frame seems to be really, really when children are the most susceptible to almost everything. Bullying, harassment, the self-esteem issues hit so much harder. They are a little bit more susceptible to manipulation because they still have that sense of when an adult tells me to do something, I do it. Whereas a teenager, you know, kind of like that 14, 15, 16, 17, they're more likely to push back because they are trying to build that sense of autonomy, right? So if possible, to wait until after middle school. Honestly, like, I'm not going to lie, I would encourage no social media until they're an adult, truthfully. I know that that's not always very realistic because even sometimes classrooms are leveraging Facebook for classroom groups and things like that. But if you can get away with waiting until after that middle school age range, and I know that varies from district to district and things like that, but kind of like aim for that 15, 16, that seems to lessen it cuts down on the risk for exploitation in a number of ways because of that more willing, like that greater sense of independence and autonomy that teenagers start to get, where their natural inclination is to push back against an adult telling them to do something.
Elliot, do you have any insight for parents that are wondering about applications like Roblox or Discord? More or less the same answer, or are there some nuance when we're just talking about, a lot of kids have an Xbox console, yep, as an example. So what about those types of platforms?
Yeah, absolutely. So the one biggest thing is someone who was the opposite of this as a kid, age ratings do exist for a reason. And when it comes to online interactions in games, very clearly on the box, it always says these are not rated. And that's for a reason. Like if you connect your kids' games to online, there's no rating system to determine what they could be exposed to. Mm-hmm. I think that the ESRB ratings for games is pretty accurate. For Roblox, like they do have different age ranges. They have in all ages, they have 9 and up and 13 and up. And then they also have a 17 and up, which is a newer category, which is you have to have an ID verification for those. But for the most part, like if you have the settings in place to actually restrict it and your kid's actual like age in there, the experiences for the most part are safe and okay. Is that going to be true all the time? No, because those are online interactions. Someone who you're playing with could be wildly inappropriate. But things like if you let your 10-year-old play Call of Duty, it is rated M. So like, is there a chance it's going to be immature themes and mature conversations and potential like harm? Maybe. It's not definite, but it's a possibility. So I think definitely respecting those ratings, and also, it's very dependent on game to game, console by console. But especially like if you're playing the games with your kids, that's a huge one. You know, encourage healthy playing habits, encourage like healthy conversations about games. Like if you use it as a family activity rather than like a siloed thing that the kid does in their bedroom, I think that also goes a long way. Cause then it's like, oh, this is a fun activity to do with dad or mom or what have you, versus like, oh, I'm going to go up to my room and do this for 10 hours.
Yeah. Jessica, I'm really interested. A lot of folks listening in are going to wonder, how do I tackle educating kids on these threats? Mm-hmm. And so I think for me as a parent, I'd like to connect the protection that we're taking and link it to the why. Because kids, I can say because I said so, but also like at a certain point in time, educating children on why we have protections in place, why they can't have Facebook yet, it's going to become necessary at a point in time. How do you handle that? I'm sure it's specific to the child, and are they aware of certain themes and topics, obviously, but how would you answer the question of how do we educate the kids so they understand why we're making these decisions?
That's a fantastic question. I know it's difficult because if you come into this conversation and you're like, well, I already have a 12-year-old and a 16-year-old, the way you approach this is going to be very different, sure, than if you are like, my kids are babies, and so I can start from scratch and I can, we can change the conversation and have it evolve as we go. So it's important to make sure that material is tailored to developmental ability. We don't want to scare kids. That's a really, really important thing. And I don't want to scare adults either, right? This is a really hard conversation to have, and there is so much misinformation out there and fear-mongering that takes place. But the reality is, knowledge is power. As cliche as that is, like anybody listening to this is, you're 50% of the way there because you're open and you're willing to absorb and learn and try this. So I would say there are a ton of resources out there that are great. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children has NetSmarts, which is tons of different modules, and they have cool graphics and animations, and it's almost like a comic book type of a thing. And that can help you give kids something that doesn't feel like they're being hit over the head with a textbook. They get enough of that in school. There are a ton of great social media accounts out there. National Center for Missing and Exploited Children has one. There are a bunch of great content creators out of Australia that give tons of tips and tricks for very age-specific groups and things like that. So finding something that not only is educational for you as a parent, but your kid is willing to engage with and listen to and absorb, I think is incredibly effective. There's also a wonderful resource that came out. It's about a 70-page report, but it talks about, from an empirical perspective, what the best ways are to teach kids and to have these conversations. And what they found was like age, like child-to-child role play is incredibly effective. Having kids actually kind of work out and problem solve how they would approach somebody asking for a nude photograph online, and doing that role play activity with their peers so that they can support each other. They can ask questions. They don't feel intimidated because they're doing this with an adult. Absolutely. Like, this report was wonderful. It was done by the Canadian Center for Children's Research, and highly recommend that parents check into that one. Again, it's lengthy, but it's tactical, it's tangible. Like, there are actually things that you can take away from that and go, these are things that I can easily implement at home and that we can do as a family to help us practice this behavior. It has to become muscle memory for kids. You have to get to the point where your kid is going, yes, mom, I know exactly, like, this is what I do when XYZ happens, because it becomes really, really easy if all of a sudden somebody is like, send me a nude photograph for that child to go, uh-oh, what do I do? So it has to be instinctual for them to go, nope, block, report, and I'm going to go tell my mom and dad.
That's great. I recently watched over the weekend, and Elliot's Rugrat themed shirt reminded me. I recently watched over the weekend a documentary on Amazon about some of the sexual abuse scandals that occurred at Nickelodeon in the late 90s. Just some heartbreaking stuff went on there. One of the things they talked about is, hey, there's a couple warning signs. In hindsight, we were just totally negligent. Somebody driving a wedge between the kids and their parents and just kind of trying to take control over the situation. Or some of these abuse scandals that occurred were a year in the making of very calculated steps taken to ultimately gain control and just take advantage of the kids. What are a couple of things that parents or guardians should be really suspicious about as it pertains to the topic of this type of abuse manifesting online? What are a couple of things that we're not saying are guaranteed signs, but really should raise the alarm for parents?
Great question. So, specific to the child, what I want parents to think about with this is, again, sink into that knowledge of, like, you know your child, you know their personality, you know what makes them laugh, you know what they like, what they don't like, and use that to kind of establish a baseline for your child. You establish their, you know, their emotional intelligence, their emotional stability, what sets them off, what makes them anxious, different things like that. And use that to have that be a litmus test for you to go, this doesn't feel right. You know, usually if Susie, you know, bombs a test or something, she might be bummed for a day, or if she has a fight with her friends, they're usually making up within 24 to 48 hours. We're going on day 5 of a lot of withdrawn behavior. That's a very, very clear sign of, if a kid who is commonly very social, very outgoing, very well connected with their parents, tells their parents everything, suddenly withdraws and is becoming very quiet and very, you know, introspective. That can be something that should warrant that parent to go, hey, we're going to go out for ice cream. Let's go have a chat. A couple other things to watch out for are a child's unwillingness to part with their device, and that's specific to kind of like online exploitation. If a child suddenly goes from being very willing to sit in the living room with their device to suddenly desperately needing to have it in their bedroom at night, high rate of device usage increase. So, you know, they're willing to put their phone down, they go run off and they play and they do this and they do that. If all of a sudden that child is like glued to it and needs to have it on them all the time and is not just having it, but is using it constantly. That is, and could be an indicator of exploitation, emotional dysregulation, whether that is anger and kind of like aggressive outbursts, or if it's, you know, sadness, depression, incredible anxiety. Stomach aches are a really, really big one. A lot of this stress can manifest in physical form. So if a child is suddenly complaining that they don't feel good and there doesn't appear to be anything physically wrong with them in terms of like the flu or a virus or something, that could be indicative that they're holding on to this anxiety and they're internalizing it. And so it's manifesting in a physical way for them. And then something else is just really, really like withdrawing from everything else that they like. You know, it's not just about suddenly being quiet. It's about, I don't want to go hang out with my friends. I don't want to go to soccer practice. I don't want to go to dance practice. I don't want to go to school. That really, really almost hermit type behavior where they just don't want to leave the house. And that could be because they're being controlled or manipulated, or because they are just so anxious and uncomfortable in the current situation that they're in. So again, you know your child, kind of check in with yourself on a regular basis, because kids are going to change. They're going to grow. Teenage hormones, all of those wonderful things, like your child is going to be changing. But if it's a super stark, quick change, that could be indicative of something more nefarious. And it's great to just approach it with, hey, you don't seem like you're doing very well. Like, let's have a conversation. I'm here. Let me help. Let's talk about this. Trying to make sure that you're not punishing or shaming, because that is definitely something that is going to push that child to withdraw even further.
Yeah, I think one thing too, like when you talk about specifically that documentary, like that's talking about like the grooming process.
Yeah,
and there's lots of different steps to that process, but the one that like we saw, like I've seen some investigations specifically like around Roblox and gaming is like the isolation, the taking to another platform, and so like doing spot checks of your kids' devices, like, hey, are they having some of these things, like some of these feelings, these mood changes, these like behavioral changes? You know, if you don't know your kids' passwords, you don't know your kids' device PIN codes, you probably should as a first off. But then like, you know, looking for apps that, you know, why does my kid have this app installed? You know, there's apps out there on the app store, you know, go to Google Play Store, Apple App Store. There's vaults, you know, vault apps like, oh, this is a calculator on the outside, but on the inside, there's images, files. Mm-hmm. Being able to know what's on your kids' phones or devices, and you know, being on the lookout for like, hey, maybe this is, you know, strange, and like, you know, being able to maybe have that conversation with them if something is maybe going on that they may be trying to hide out of shame, fear, guilt, any of those type of emotions.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you, by the way, for wearing the Rugrats shirt today. It's very nostalgic. I love it.
No problem.
Okay, so let's say, you know, the warning signs are there. You have a conversation. Let's start off on one end of the spectrum. Let's say that there is maybe some early signs of grooming occurring that come to light. What are the next steps?
Fantastic question. So I love to give this to parents in almost like a checklist sort of, you know, step-by-step process, because it's very, very easy to all of a sudden go, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening in our family. So first and foremost, as a parent or guardian, like you cannot freak out. You have to stay calm, like let the storm rage, whatever is happening inside you. But outwardly, the first thing you should be doing is saying, I'm glad you told me, you're safe, you did nothing wrong, we're gonna fix this. So staying calm is very, very important. Second thing, and this is going to vary because exploitation can happen in a way where the child doesn't feel like they're being exploited. They feel like they're in a relationship. They feel like this person is their, you know, their partner or their significant other. So you have children who are not going to want this to stop, and then you have children who are going to want this to stop. Either way, you need to confiscate that device. And your best bet is to put it into airplane mode, or you can put it in a Faraday bag, but most people don't have a Faraday bag sitting around that's going to block the signals from coming and going. So put it in airplane mode. That means that nobody can get into it and mess with any of the content. Content isn't going to disappear. Make sure that you do not delete anything, especially if images have been exchanged. And kind of a secondary part of that, do not send anything anywhere. A lot of parents will go, well, send me the images and then I can give them to law enforcement. Don't do that, because then mom, dad, you know, aunt, uncle, whoever the guardian is, your phone is going into evidence at law enforcement too. So don't send anything anywhere. Keep it on that child's device. Make sure that you confiscate all devices. So it can't just be the phone. It has to be the tablet. It might be the old phone that still technically has a SIM card and is sitting in a drawer, but hasn't been turned on in a while. Collect them all, especially if the child doesn't feel like they're being exploited, because they are more than likely going to go try to find another way to contact their abuser. So you also have to be mindful of friends and different things like that. So in those cases, I also recommend that parents change passwords. So whether they've been, you know, communicating on Discord, Snapchat, and Instagram, as many accounts as you can, do password resets for all of those, the accounts, so the children cannot log back in and they cannot continue to communicate with the abuser. The abuser profile should be reported to all of the platforms, and every platform kind of has a different process for that. It's usually pretty easy, but make sure any platform that you know that they were communicating on, parents and children should report that account as being problematic. Next step is write everything down. So whether the child was communicating over the course of 5 minutes or the course of a year, sit down with them and help them kind of write out a timeline. And that should include every single identifier that abuser has provided. So if they say they're a male, they say they live in this specific town, they say they're 26 years old, you know, they work this kind of a job, anything that can help law enforcement identify them and, you know, match an identity to any search warrant data that they get back from those platforms is going to be very, very helpful. It's also going to be a way for the children to process through that as well. So you kind of let them drive the conversation, make sure that you are truly just there as like the note taker. You're not passing judgment. You're just helping them go, okay, then what happened? Or what happened next? And just let them kind of brain dump and you write everything down. And then you should always report these things to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children through their cyber tip line, which can be done over the phone where you can talk to a real person, or they have a form online. You would not upload any images there, but you'll give usernames, handles, explain the situation. And what's going to happen then is they are going to coordinate with law enforcement to be able to ensure that that case gets to the correct agency, because this might be an issue where the offender is overseas. Well, that's not going to go to your local, you know, city police department. It's probably going to go to the FBI or HSI, depending on the severity and things like that. I know that not everyone is comfortable working with law enforcement. And truthfully, there are situations where putting a child through a full-blown criminal investigation actually is not going to be good for that child. So everything that I've mentioned previously can be done sans law enforcement, though as a professional, I always want to recommend that people contact law enforcement because it establishes a paper trail. And that doesn't necessarily mean that is going to go to prosecution, that a child's going to be put through a criminal court case or a trial or anything like that. But establishing a paper trail is very, very important, because child predators on average go 12 years before their first contact with law enforcement.
Wow.
So if they are offending against a child and say it's only year two of their operation, or their, you know, they're offending, and the child's parents know that and they decide not to call, not to file a report, well, 6 years down the road, when the next victim comes up, had that report been in place, law enforcement could refer back and go, this is their second time that they've been called on us. We really need to pay attention to this. So I do recommend that people file a law enforcement request there, and then, a law enforcement report. And then last but not least, like, getting your child help. The trauma of these situations can manifest right away, or sometimes it can manifest later because you're in a lot of shock, and it can be very traumatic and it can be very long-lasting, especially if images were exchanged, or if even, you know, more so there was a hands-on offense that took place. So making sure that you try to get ahead of that to the best of your ability and seek out help, whether it is physical, mental health. And then the last thing is, if pictures were exchanged, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children also has a link to a program called Take It Down, where you can send them the images that were shared or that were uploaded to whatever website. They don't store the images. They don't look at the images. All they do is they take the metadata from that picture and they create a digital fingerprint or a hash for it. What they can then do is throw that hash into a system that is constantly scanning the internet to look for matches. And so if all of a sudden they find a match to that hash, they work with the social media companies to get that image removed immediately, especially if it is known and designated as child sexual abuse material, which is also another reason to bring law enforcement in, because law enforcement is the only entity that can say and give that stamp of, yes, we have designated this as CSAM. So, but that is something that should absolutely, and even if you're a child and you shared a photo and you don't know if it's been uploaded anywhere, you don't know if it will be, you can still report that image to Take It Down. They'll create the hash and they'll monitor for it. It might never pop up anywhere, but it's this nice safety net that you can leverage, because the second that it goes anywhere, they can work on having it scrubbed from the internet.
Yeah. That's great.
The one thing I'll add to that too is, you know, oftentimes, you know, if your child's been the victim of an abuser, you know, the gut reaction can be anger. Like, you never want to approach the offender.
Absolutely.
Because you do that, you know, that could ruin a law enforcement investigation. It could, you know, the offender will delete all their devices, you know, smash all the evidence, and then being able to prosecute that is extremely hard then. Because then all you have is, you know, half the evidence is gone. So that's one thing that's like, you don't want to exhaust, it can escalate and cause more pain, more suffering for the child. And letting the experts be able to handle that work is a big one.
I'm going to get back to that point in a second. Elliot, I've got a good question for you in regards to that. Thank you for laying out that process, super informative process. How would it different if, you know, instead of perhaps there were some images or some exploitation, perhaps there was a meeting or a series of meetings, or let's put it this way. If the severity was level 10, how would it affect the recommended steps?
The recommended steps are going to be the same, because more than likely, unless it is, you know, a neighbor or an acquaintance or something like that, where there is a physical relationship, where there's, I should say, a proximity relationship, you still need to, your law enforcement is still going to need to go through all of that same evidence. Unfortunately, most of the time there is some parental grooming that happens with hands-on abusers, especially if they are, you know, close family friends, neighbors, family members. And so there will be those digital interactions that law enforcement is going to want to look at and take a peek at. So even if there aren't images, there will likely be a search warrant or a subpoena offered up so that law enforcement can look at the exchanges of messages and things like that. But in that case, you know, the first step absolutely stays the same. It needs to be making sure that your child feels safe and they know that, like, we're not going to let this happen anymore. And these situations can be incredibly traumatic and incredibly difficult, because this is someone you know, this is, what if it is a family member and you're going, oh my God, I have to call law enforcement on my brother-in-law, or I have to call law enforcement on this, you know, coach who is beloved by the entire town. One of the really important things is for parents to know that it is not their responsibility to be the determining factor of did this not happen. That is on law enforcement. You as the parent, your responsibility is to your child. And less than 10% of cases involve false allegations, particularly the younger you get. So as a parent, you have to call law enforcement. You have to file that report. And law enforcement, they are the ones who have to, you know, meet the burden of proof, do the investigation. So all you should be thinking about is, I'm going to make sure that my child is safe. I'm going to make sure that they are away from the alleged abuser, and I'm going to be cooperative with law enforcement in that regard. But all of the same steps, you know, if you need to change Wi-Fi passwords, if you need to change locks on the doors, perhaps, if you have to confiscate devices because maybe it was a neighbor who was communicating with the child on Facebook, say, just for example, and then they moved to a hands-on sexually abusive relationship, something like that. But keeping in line with kind of that checklist of things is very important, particularly not freaking out, making sure that your child is safe, and then getting help at the end of things if that is the case and if the situation requires it.
Yeah, thanks for giving us all that information. Really helpful information there. What resources are available for parents that just immediately want to learn a little bit more? And do you mind queuing up the future project that we're working on together with ClickSafe and Winona IT? Just let folks know what to expect in the near future there.
Absolutely. So there are, I've already mentioned some of the resources that are out there. Again, NCMEC, or National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, has some wonderful resources available to parents. They even have conversation starters. So if you're like, I have no idea how to tackle the topic of sextortion, go to NCMEC. They can give you ways, they can give you the information to help you establish kind of the background and the issue in and of itself. And they have questions to ask. They have, you know, information to pass along, which is absolutely wonderful. And really any of the other organizations out there that deal with child exploitation, like the Internet Watch Foundation, has a ton of wonderful resources. Polaris Project has, even though they're more dedicated to human trafficking, child exploitation is a part of human trafficking. So they have resources as well. And again, lots of different social media accounts, which are wonderful. And that's the whole purpose of ClickSafe, is to be able to offer parents, teachers, law enforcement, and child safety professionals all of the education that they need. Eventually, we are going to have downloadable courses that you can take off the internet. Our social media, the purpose is to consistently be giving out, you know, tips, tricks, information, new cases that come out. We break down empirical research so that people can understand it, because it's really hard reading a 65-page write-up of a psychological study that was done on, you know, male sexual offenders. So we take the burden off you guys. We go through it and we tell you the meat and potatoes of what you need to know there. And coming down the pipeline here, we are going to be doing this wonderful project with Winona IT and putting out a ton of educational information for this local community here. So we want to be able to give not just teachers, but teachers of certain age groups of kids relevant information on how to spot, how to respond to, and how they can help prevent the exploitation of their students, as well as all of that same information for parents. And I think the thing that I'm even most excited about is we're going to be training the next generation of educators as well with the local university here. So being able to give these college students information that they get to take with them into the classroom before they're even, you know, tenured teachers is phenomenal. So I really hope we kind of see some changes, you know, down around the corner a ways from now, that we can really start preventing this stuff or stopping it much faster. And Elliot, am I forgetting anything here? I'm sure I'm forgetting stuff.
I think also the kids' education as well, being able to have education for the children as well, like different age groups.
I think we've, you know, over the years at Winona IT, we've gotten a lot of questions from parents about keeping kids safer online. Mm-hmm. And it's been a tough question to answer. I mean, it's a very tough, there's so many things we've talked about today that it's so hard to just respond with an email, respond with a text. And what I have really come to understand is the schools, the community, as an IT partner, we can contribute. We can really tackle this together as a group. And what folks are going to see from us in the near future is, I think, a wonderful project that's going to really make a local difference. So very excited about that.
It's going to be great. I can't wait.
Yeah, forward to it.
Any closing thoughts here before we wrap up?
I would just say, like, I know that this is a really tough conversation, and there, I always joke that, you know, when I have to talk about this, I ruin people's day with the information that I give out. But the reality is, like, we can't prosecute our way out of this problem. We can't educate our way out of this problem. It is really, like you said, a multifaceted approach, because it's an incredibly insidious issue. And with ever-evolving technology, it's just going to become more complicated. So it's going to be better for us to, you know, lean in, to ask the hard questions, to have the really uncomfortable conversations, whether it's with one another, whether it's with our teachers, our community leaders, our, you know, the social media companies. It breaks my heart when I see the kind of infighting that happens around this topic, because frankly, in my opinion, there's just no room for that. Like, we have to protect our kids, because it's their childhood. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's that's everything. It's setting up them to become the next generation of humans. And we have to do this together, and we cannot be afraid of these hard conversations in order to be able to do it. We're going to be able to tackle it a lot faster and a lot more effectively if we just all come to the table and say, like, it's our job to link arms around this and to make it stop, rather than pointing fingers and saying, it's your job, it's your job, it's your job.
That's great. That's super helpful. Thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for flying out here. Elliot, thank you as well for the long drive out here and joining us today. Folks, thanks for sticking with us through a difficult topic. Really, really appreciate all the listeners. And please look for a couple follow-ups in the near future. We appreciate you joining in today. Thank you.